Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Spicer from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Perceptive Podcast. My guest tonight is returning fan of the site and owner of PsychologyOfGames.com and the recent author of the book Getting Gamers, The Psychology of Video Games. Please welcome Jamie Madigan.
Thanks, Josh. I'm glad to come back.
Yep, it's great to talk to you again, Jamie. It's been, I think, like a few months, maybe even like about a year since we last spoke.
Yeah, it could be a year or more.
Yeah, crazy. We are, of course, recording this in almost late November now, and the year is almost up, and that, of course, means it's going to be time for Game of the Year awards, and, of course, that last big AAA push that's going to be happening.
Yep, my backlog is grown quite a lot, and just...
My backlog's still here from, like, 2012, 2013. It's never going to go away at this point.
Oh, yeah. I don't even want to look at Steam, but, you know, at least on disk stuff, I got a few things that I'm working through and then looking forward to working through.
Yeah, at some point I need to play Bloodborne because everyone's been talking about that. And I'm like the last like Dark Souls fan to actually get that.
Yeah, I picked that up a while back. I actually pretty much bought a PS4 just to play that.
Yeah,
and,
that's what I'm thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, I managed to play most of the way through it, but I still need to go back and finish it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe at some point it'll get on the PC, but who knows? It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I think they said no. So for the time being, they're not planning on porting it, but you never know when those plans could change.
Yeah. All right. So our big topic for tonight, we're going to be talking about motivators in video games, things or elements that keep someone playing or something that will keep someone coming back or to, like, you know, put their head down, plow through a game. And it's going to be very interesting to talk about that. Obviously, with your background, Jamie, in terms of psychology, I know you've written a lot of posts and a lot of looks at things or elements that either attract someone or keep them playing. And that's why I wanted you on for tonight's cast.
Yeah, I got a whole chapter in the book about sort of why do we grind, why do we chase achievements, why do we try to clear out our quest logs. It looks some of the psychology and some of the theories of motivation around that. So, Yep,
awesome. And we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. But first, as we've said a few minutes ago, it's been a while since Jamie's been on, so I figure we'll do a little catch-up, talk about some of the games we've played lately, and then we'll get to that juicy topic. So, Jamie, why don't you go first and tell the fine folks, what have you been up to?
So I am, like a lot of folks, neck deep in Fallout 4 at the moment. I was playing it right before I got up to take this call, and I'll probably go right back to it once we're done here. It's great. I'm not deep into it. I've played, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 hours total at this point, and I'm just really, really enjoying it. And I enjoyed Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas, and this is that plus a lot more on next generation hardware. Mm.
I was talking to Ken the other night about it. He is also loving it. He's like staying up to like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning getting it done. But yeah, my entire friends list is just Fallout 4 for like the last week and a half.
Yeah.
And I was telling a few other people, I just have no interest in playing Fallout 4. And I've spoken about this.
Weird.
I know. And this is coming from the psychologist telling me I'm weird. So that's a double right there. But this goes back to a podcast I did, I think, last year when we were talking about RPG design. And on that cast, I just said that the whole Bethesda style of RPG just, it hasn't hooked me yet. I tried Skyrim, tried Oblivion. Hell, I've tried Fallout 3 and New Vegas. And it just never really got into me the same way that other more, I guess, mechanical-based RPGs have. Like, the last RPG that I just, you know, obsessed over was Xenoblade Chronicles for the Wii. And I spent pretty much, I think, over 100 hours in that game. And that was, like, the last time that I really got that in-depth into an RPG. And from what Ken was telling me, they've definitely streamlined a lot of the elements around Fallout compared to previous titles. Is that right?
Yeah, they seem to have done some streamlining on the the perks and sort of the way the character progression works. And mm-hmm. but at the same time, they've introduced these new systems, like an overhaul crafting system, an upgrade system for weapons and armor, mm-hmm. and your power armor, that adds a whole new layer to the game. And they've kind of made like scavenging the wasteland for bits and bobs and little miscellaneous objects that you pick up meaningful in another way. Besides just trading them in for cash, you can break them down into components. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you'll pick up a microscope and you can break that down into, you know, glass and some lenses, maybe a crystal, and you can break down, you know, a hot plate and stir out the copper. And then you use those components to upgrade your weapons. And, you know, the more and better perks you have in that area, the more upgrades you can do. So I'm playing kind of a cross between an old West gunslinger and a mechanical engineer who, so, you know, I'm taking all those perks and I'm running around grabbing everything I can and then upgrading all of my armor and all of my weapons, mostly like bullet based weapons instead of the energy stuff. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm playing it on the PS4. I strongly considered getting it on the PC just so I could have access to the mods, mm-hmm. and strip out some stuff that's annoying, like encumbrance. Mm-hmm. But I'm still having a great time with it.
And in terms of like the general like play of it, like I've heard some people say that it's a lot more action based. At least if the tactile feel of the shooting is a lot better compared to previous titles. Is that right?
I wouldn't say I've noticed more shooting mm-hmm. than say Fallout 3 or New Vegas, but the shooty bits have got better. It plays closer to a typical first person shooter. Mm. You know, where you can go and not use the VATS, which is the system that sort of freezes time mm-hmm. or slows time down a lot and then lets you like target and spend action points to shoot. It still has that, but you know, if you're out of action points or you just want to go at it like a normal shooter, it works better. There's still some element of randomness. You know, you'll fire a bullet and it'll go off at like a crazy angle and you'll miss. You know, it's still a role-playing game. But it blends sort of, I point my gun at something and bullets come out and hit the thing a lot more, I think, than previous Fallout games did.
All right. Now, another aspect behind like Bethesda's style, at least from the games I've played, is having all the content scale. I remember this was a big deal in Oblivion, I know was toned mm-hmm. back in Skyrim. Is that present in Fallout 4 at all?
I don't think so. From what I've heard, stuff gets tougher the further away from the starting zone, the starting area that you get, mm-hmm. but it doesn't scale with your level. So you're not going to go out there and find, you know, a level 150 rad roach. It's mm-hmm. going to be just like the rad roaches you were killing during the tutorial part of the game. So it seems to me like the more you move away from the top left corner of the map, you know, the more, you know, super mutants and Deathclaws, mm-hmm. and then they start adding on like modifiers, like, okay, it's a legendary Deathclaw, or you know, even like a legendary rad roach, which doesn't really make sense, but you know, the idea is that it's tougher yeah. than a normal one. So you'll get those types of rad roaches, but no, it doesn't seem to scale in the same way that previous games have.
That's good to hear. It sounds like they've been really fine-tuning a lot of the design. One of the things I heard was interesting that Ken and I were talking about was that a lot of people have been complaining about like the bugs in the game, but he said that there seems to be less bugs in this one compared to previous Bethesda titles at launch.
Yeah, again, I'm playing on the PS4, and I've had one like hard crash to the PS4 dashboard, mm-hmm. and I've had a few other things where it'd be weird, like you know, there's a Brahmin, which are like these big double-headed cow things, will just like magically appear inside of a tiny shower inside of a house. And, you know, you get like weird spawning issues like that and clipping, and, you know, people are sort of like half stuck in the ground. And I got stuck in geometry once or twice, but it does actually seem to be better than previous games. I haven't run into so far any game ending bugs where scripting gets broken or like a, you know, an NPC refuses to acknowledge that I've done the thing or, mm-hmm. or anything like that. So, but you know, there's a lot more game left. So who knows?
Yeah. And from what it's been getting in terms of reviews, it seems to be going really well. Yeah, at least in terms of like the main market. I forget what game recently made like broke another big sales record, but this is definitely the time for the AAA release. Have they announced like anything in terms of what like the season pass is going to start doing, like future content?
I don't know. I don't ever pay attention to that stuff, honestly. You know, the clerk will ask, like, do you want to sign up for the season pass? And it's just, no, not interested. If it's good, I'll take it. I just hate not knowing what I'm buying ahead of time. You know, I have no idea what that season pass will be. And, you know, another game that I played earlier this year was Batman Arkham Knight. And, you know, the season pass stuff for that turned out to be, like, oh, here's some skins, and then here's a couple of really good pieces of content. But I just would rather buy those good pieces of content once they come out and people have reacted to them and I hear that they're worth it. Yeah. Even if I do pay, you know, $10 more in the long run, I'd rather do that than take a chance.
Yeah. And it will be interesting to see how the game develops. Now, one thing that I thought was going to be interesting is if Bethesda was going to try to reintroduce the paying mod thing that they were trying to do earlier this year with Skyrim.
Yeah, that's the conjecture, but I haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah. And that in and of itself is a conversation we could definitely spend a good hour on there. We've talked about it several times in the past with other guests. But I guess just to quickly or briefly wrap up talking about Fallout 4, what did you make of the whole paying mod thing? Obviously, as a fan of Bethesda, and as you said earlier, about those mods that are used to, like, essentially quality of life mods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, respect my time more mods. I think the kerfluffle with Skyrim, it was just really badly handled. It was just kind of not gracefully or intelligently communicated, and they came out and it seemed like they were trying to take away something that people had for free. And there's a lot of psychological research, for example, that says that, you know, once people feel like they have something, they are very averse to losing it, and they will make a lot of noise and be very unhappy about the prospect of losing those options, even if it didn't if it wouldn't necessarily have worked out that way. But I think I hear in practice that you sort of have like these cascading dependencies of mods where if one person who had a mod that provided an underlying framework for other mods decided to charge, then that just sort of goofed up the whole thing. And I think Bethesda would have been a lot better off waiting until a new product like Fallout 4 to roll that out so that it's like, okay, clean slate. You've got everything that you had before, but here's this new thing. It's got no mods as of now, and that then going in the future, we can sort of coordinate better, and you'll be paying to get access to these things as opposed to paying to keep from losing them.
Yeah.
Even though those things are equivalent, we perceive them differently and we react to them very differently.
Yeah, and that goes back to another issue with regarding what you do with pricing your game. You can always lower your price. No one's going to raise any objections, but if you try to raise your price, people are going to get very angry with you. Even if the game is in early access and, you know, you tell them this game is $10 now, but it's going to go up in value, obviously, as time goes on, as with the case of Minecraft and Kerbal Space Program.
Oh, did they go up? Oh, I know Minecraft did. Yeah, I didn't know Kerbal Space Program had.
Yeah, Kerbal, I think it was like originally like $5 or $10. And if you bought it, like this was pre-Steam, pre-early access, if you bought it from them, like, I don't even remember what version number, you were guaranteed basically free updates for life. All DLC, all everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it came to Steam, it went up a little bit, and they said, okay, at this point, if you buy and release any DLC or microtransactions with it, you will have to pay for that. But, you know, all free updates and that work will still be free.
Yeah. Yeah, again, a lot of it just comes down to how you pitch it. You know, if it's we're raising the price versus we're offering a discount for early, you know, early adopters and early supporters, that's the way that you can frame that and you can pitch it. It, you know, it's not a surplus or a service charge that you're paying. It's a discount that that you're getting by doing by getting in early.
Yeah, and that perception of how consumers will see your decisions and how you as a developer, even in just in any product-based or consumer-based industry, how you react or how you explain things can be critical to getting that right perception. We've seen so many bad ad campaigns. We've seen, honestly, in the game industry, we've seen a lot of developers just completely blow up and basically self-implode mm-hmm. when they go nuts on a Twitter account, make a bad post. And that perception is such a key thing. It goes back to one of the things I've talked about a lot on this cast, is the importance of good PR. Either you have to do it or you need someone on your team who can handle that for you.
Yeah, yeah. It turns out that marketing and PR are actually things that some people are better at than others and that are important. And we don't like to admit it because they're kind of often seen as, well, I'm going to spin things or distort the truth. But
yeah,
if you're a developer, then they can be pretty important.
Yeah. And as a good lead into what I'm going to talk about with my game and regarding that perception or how you present yourself, have you been following? Oh, I know I'm on Broken Form. You were also talking about this as well with Payday 2 and just the entire downward spiral of the last month over their perception.
Yeah, that was fascinating to watch in a grim kind of way.
Yeah, that definitely is up there with, Hindenburg and Titanic in terms of, the humanity of what's been going on there. And at this point, as we're doing this recording right now, it's died down, but it's definitely simmering on the forums there. They botched another big release of their $30, I'm not sure what would you call it? I guess customer loyalty purchase. You could spend $30 and get exclusive stuff. Mm-hmm. And they basically, after not telling anyone what the final reward is, they basically gave us all random skins. And the random skins also differed in quality. So someone got like a $100 mm-hmm. skin. I think I got like a $10 skin. And other people may have gotten like a $2 or $3. And it goes back to the dreaded microtransaction update, which actually corresponds really well to what we were just saying regarding the perception of how something is presented to the consumer. The whole microtransaction thing has been a huge issue, and as you were just saying, Jamie, it's just really blown up in their face in terms of how they presented that. Which, as we've talked about a few times on the cast, the game originally wasn't supposed to have microtransactions, and then they mm-hmm. changed their mind. And it's just getting, it doesn't seem to be getting any better. I know people have had, this one, like the strange things about the game industry, when consumers feel threatened or lied to or angry, they will fight back. And right now there's a concentrated effort to lower Payday 2's Metacritic score, to lower its Steam reviews.
Yeah.
Basically they're doing everything they can to, I guess, quote unquote, strike back at Overkill.
Yeah, and it's kind of depressing that you can almost outline a standard playbook for that sort of stuff where, mm-hmm. It's about attacking user reviews on places like Metacritic and Amazon and Steam and all that sort of stuff, and just trying to do in volume what you can. And it's easy to organize large groups of people on the internet when the barrier to entry isn't very high, and when it's pretty easy just to click a few buttons. So yeah, it's been really interesting. And it was sort of framed as taking something away, or at least that's the way that people seem to have perceived it. Mm-hmm. Like apparently none of the new stuff was for purchase only, right? Couldn't you get it through in-game drops, just like you can in a lot of different games?
The trick is that, now this is just from what I've heard, this is not, I don't know this 100% to be true or not, but from what people are saying, once a week, you have a chance of getting either a drill, which will unlock like the safe, or aka the skin, mm-hmm. or getting the safe, which is essentially the box you need to open. It's the similar system that Team Fortress had.
Okay, so the drill is a key, essentially.
Yeah, it's a $2.50 key, at least in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you can only get either one of those things once a week. So
It's TF2 doesn't even let you get keys. You have to buy those all the time.
Mm-hmm. And what people are complaining about in terms of the skins is that a lot of the rarer skins will also confer bonuses to your weapons. Mm. And they've also added in, now certain skins will give your entire team a boost in terms of money and experience. So they're really hammering in trying to make these skins have some kind of perceived or intrinsic value by giving all these in-game bonuses. But the chance of getting a drill is so low that it pretty much obviously will pay to spend the $2.50. But just like with Team Fortress, you don't know what you're going to get. At least with Team Fortress, everything that's gameplay affecting, you can get it through the random drop system or just buy it straight through the store.
Or craft it or buy it from other players, yeah.
Yeah, which there doesn't seem to be that option here. I know you can trade the drills, but it's hard to see how you would get a good deal when everyone knows that the flat rate is $250 for it.
Yeah, they seem to have really crossed a line where they went from, okay, everything is purely cosmetic, you got these cool weapon skins, to you got these cool weapon skins that give you a plus to this and a plus to that. That, in a lot of people's mind, really seems to change the equation and change the perception of how things work. I wrote an article on the website, and I actually did a podcast with one of the authors of the study where they looked at how people perceive other players who engage in microtransactions for sort of pay-to-win type items. So items that actually give you a bonus versus items that give you only like a cosmetic change. Mm-hmm. And you know, their findings were that people sort of look down on those people who, you know, bought a play to win solution or you know, bought a coin doubler or an EXP doubler or any of those sorts of things. They were less likely to want them on their team. They were more likely to like not resurrect them or like revive them or help them in the game. You know, if they knew that they had paid for these types of items with real money.
Payday 2 has been really bad with that. I know, I don't think you've played the game. Have you played it at all, Jamie? Either
no.
Before? Okay.
I watched a couple of Let's Plays when this was all going down just to try to get my head around it, but I've never actually played it, no.
Oh, in-game, at least the 2 weeks during the Crime Fest and then the Black Market update, which is the weapon skins, was definitely a horrible time. There are people who kick anyone with a skin, call them names that I cannot repeat in good conversation. Someone called me a few nice words because I was using a free skin that I got from one of the events. But a lot, as you said, they just don't care. You know, if you have it, they perceive you as, quote-unquote, the enemy. You're supporting it, which means that you're against them. Therefore, you know, go F yourself and so much worse, they'll say to you.
So it was more along the lines of, yeah, even though you could get that for free or from a drop, you're not joining our crusade to abstain from wearing the skins and boycott the whole thing, huh?
Yeah, you know, you're either with us or you're against us type mentality. Mm-hmm. And we could definitely talk a whole lot more about that, but that will definitely take us over, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours easily talking more. So, but it is a good lead in into talking about regarding perception of how a game is presented to someone, talking about my game that I've been playing lately, and that is Killing Floor 2. Hmm. So Killing Floor 2 is obviously the sequel to the first game developed by Tripwire Interactive. For those of you listening, my interview is currently up with them talking more about the game. I'll include a link to that in the podcast notes below. And Killing Floor 2, this is the first time Tripwire is doing early access with it. And you can buy it now, you get access to it, and then when the game is done, you know, you'll just flip over from alpha to retail. So, in terms of content, in terms of like the core feedback loop or the main gameplay component, it's definitely good. It's pretty much Killing Floor 1 with a much, much, much nicer engine.
Hmm.
Have you ever played have you ever seen footage of Killing Floor 2 or played Killing Floor 1?
No, I was just going to ask you to like sort of explain what the game is. Like, what kind of game is it and what are your verbs and what do you do?
Yeah, no problem. Killing Floor it was based on a mod, Tripwire, as a brief history lesson. They started out as a bunch of modders. They worked with Unreal. And then they took that skill to turn some of their mods into actual games. They did a more realistic shooter called Red Orchestra. I think this was 2004, 2005. I'm not 100% sure. And they used that momentum to help turn themselves into the company Tripwire. So their big game, the one that I think probably has given them the most recognition, is the Killing Floor series. And it's a co-op wave or horde-based gameplay. So you have to survive waves of enemies coming at you. You have these different mutants are going to attack you. The maps are designed to be really huge. Enemies are going to spawn off screen and basically try to mob you the best they can. Some enemies are faster. Some are basically heavy, bulky guys who, if they get close to you, they're just going to kill you right away. And the concept is that it's teamwork without making it explicit. Like, if you played Left 4 Dead, there are enemies like the Special Infected were completely designed to trap a player. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, one second. So, like, the smoker would pull a player and run them incapacitated, so you needed someone to help you. In Killing Floor 2, or in Killing Floor as a series, there aren't any specific enemies. No one's going to grab you or take you out of combat. Instead, it's designed so that you are forced to work together because you will die if you're alone. The waves themselves, or the number of enemies you fight each round, it scales depending upon the number of players in the game. So if it's just by myself, I may get a 20 enemy wave. If I'm playing with 6-7 people, it could be a 200-300 enemy wave. And you have somewhat low ammo counts. Each weapon has its own ammo supply, so you're encouraged to buy like two primary weapons, so you have a backup in case you run out of ammo on your other one. And a lot of the enemies, as I said, they are going to rush you every chance they get. I believe from what I've seen, they spawn in like groups. You may get like 30 guys, then another 30, and they may try to time so as you're finishing one part of the wave, the next wave will spawn. And later enemies, like the two biggest enemies, I think one's called the Skakes, I don't know the exact name, and this heavy guy called the Flesh Pounder, which you can tell by that name, he's a melee guy.
Yeah, it sort of says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah. And these guys are designed that if you start shooting them, they're going to go berserk, and they're going to run at you faster than you could actually run away from them. So they're designed to basically tell the group that, hey, we all have to stop our individual stuff and focus on these guys, or they're just going to run around and kill everyone one at a time. And you die, you're out for that wave, and then if the team survives without you, you'll come back the next wave. And with Killing Floor 2, they've added in a more involved progression system, or what they call perks. The perks are essentially classes in the game. Whatever perk you choose, you'll get special innate bonuses. Like maybe one perk will give you faster reloads or make you weld doors quicker, stuff like that. And as you go up in the perk by killing enemies and performing tasks, you'll be able to assign special passive bonuses. Like maybe you'll hold 50% more ammo, or maybe if you use a flamethrower, it'll do more damage, stuff like that. And it's just completely co-op. It's I guess sort of halfway between being an arcade shooter and being more realistic. Like, guns have, like, heft. There's weight to the guns. You can't just equip 10 shotguns and, you know, run around like that.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between hip firing and aiming down the sight. And it's definitely a fun time. It's one of those games like Left 4 Dead, that if you can get, like, 6-7 friends or even just, like, 3-4 with you, you can have a good time trying to survive with each other. And the scaling system works so that it's not like Left 4 Dead where you need 8 people or bus kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the big change is the engine. I think they're on Unreal Engine 3 or 4, I'm not sure. So the game looks really nice. You know, enemies blow up and get disarmed, very bloody and gore-filled. But the problem I have with the game, which I put up my spotlight on the site as of the time of this recording, pretty much I think the same day, is that there's just not much of an incentive to keep playing. And this again will lead into talking more about motivators in a few minutes. Right now, the only form of progression is grinding the perk level. So you go from level 1 to level 25, and it's just a really slow burn because you need a lot of experience to do it. There are a bunch of achievements in the game, like beat the map on easy, beat the map on suicidal is one of the difficulty levels.
Yeah.
But there's no like real difference between playing on one map versus the other. Like in Left 4 Dead, for example, each one of the campaigns had like its own personality. You had to do different things, there were different situations set up. Currently in Killing Floor 2, every map is simply horde-based, you know, survive as long as you can, or, you know, die very very gruesomely from an enemy.
Hmm.
So, it's definitely coming along. Now, here's the bit of the controversy or the sticking point that a lot of people are complaining about. As I said, the game is in early access, and what Tripwire is doing is, unlike other developers who go for, like, a set upgrade schedule, set time to add more stuff to the game, they're basically going the Blizzard, you know, quote-unquote, when it's done mantra. So they're holding on to content, instead of releasing, like, once a week or once a month updates, they're waiting, you know, months on end. I think it's been, like, 3 or 4 months since their last update. And then they're going to do something big. Like, they're going to add, like, an entire new perk class or entire new weapons tree, etc. And it's annoying people because they're more used to that perception of early access being a game that's constantly evolving. Stuff like Darkest Dungeon, Prison Architect, etc.
Yeah.
And here, it's pretty much a slow burn. They're saying they're going to be working on this game for years. But who knows in between that time when we're going to see new stuff. Like, for example, I can pull this up quickly on Steam. You gotta love how they tell you how long you've spent playing a game.
And it's not even out yet.
Yeah, I've spent about 14 hours, which honestly is quite light considering some of the other games I've played. But
pretty sure that's longer than I spent on Halo 5 a couple of weeks ago.
But it's going to be nowhere near as long as most people are going to spend on Fallout 4. I can guarantee that one. But I'm not even at 20 hours in, and I'm starting to feel that malaise, you know, that I'm just going through the motions instead of learning new stuff. Compared to, say, like Payday 2, which has its whole progression system, Call of Duty is a great example of all the little ways it motivates someone to keep playing.
Mm-hmm.
And with Killing Floor 2, I've just hit that point where there's just no more growth outside of the grinding for my perk. And again, I have no idea when the next update's coming. Supposedly, it's going to add a new class. And actually, I can, just looking at their Steam page, one second, I can tell you that the last actual quote-unquote update to Killing Floor 2 was August 3rd of this year. That's when they added in 2 new perks to the system. So it's been been a little over
3 months. Yeah.
Yeah, since it came out. And again, when you look at something like Prison Architect, they were, you know, hard, dead set on once a month new update. Now, of course, you know, the quality of those updates vary. You know, 1 month they may just do a bug crush. Next one they may add in, you know, a new schedule system. But it was consistent updates. So this goes back to, I think, what we were talking about a few minutes ago, Jamie, with that the perception from the consumer standpoint. If they don't see you, they don't see like new content in a game, they start to wonder, you know, what exactly are you doing, you know, for 3-4 months of time.
Yeah, and I think maybe the rules are a little bit different with an early access game. You can't necessarily expect to have a completed game and can't necessarily assume that you'll get things that the same things and the same on the same schedule that you will when it's complete. I typically don't do early access games sort of for the same reason that I described. I don't do season passes for DLC. Yeah. It's just like, tell me when the game's done and I'll buy it. Few exceptions to those. I bought Darkest Dungeon because I really liked what I saw and played that for a few hours and really liked it. But then I was like, okay, this is going to be good. And I'm just going to set it aside and wait for it to be done, which didn't they say like this month or December for that to be done?
The latest news I've heard, there's going to be a big content update November 30th. And they are planning on, I think, releasing the game either late December or January is the last I've actually heard.
I'm looking forward to it. That's a really cool little game. But yeah, I don't know. I guess it's different if they set expectations up front, like I guess apparently the Prison Architect folks did, to say, okay, and on the 15th of every month or whatever, you know, we're going to have a patch, or, and you're going to get something and we can tell you what's coming up, versus just sort of like this, well, I don't know, it'll be done when it's done. Yeah, that's annoying and it's demotivating, but at the same time, like, that's what you signed up for with early access.
Yeah, and good point there, Jamie. I'm definitely feeling the same way about early access. I mean, I bought Darkest Dungeon 2. I played the hell out of it. I could keep playing it, but then I just risk burning out completely on it.
Yeah,
I've done like a few let's plays of it on YouTube and Twitch, but I'm just really trying to save all that excitement for version 1.0 and then just, you know, hit it hard and probably spend like a week or two playing it every day.
Yeah, and when it's all balanced, or as balanced as it's probably going to get, and all the content is in there, all the classes, and you don't have to play through the tutorial, you know, every week or every time a new patch comes out.
And I guess to wrap up talking about Killing Floor 2 then, I mean, as I said, it's definitely not a bad game. It, for the content that's in there right now, it's good. And I'm, as we were just saying, I bet when the game is finally done, it's going to be that amazing, oh my god, I gotta play it every day type game. But right now, it's really not there. From what they're saying, they are shooting for like 3 to 4 months maybe for a patch. They have a whole post up on the Steam forum about how much time and work goes into the type of content. Like they said, I can pull this up quickly. Like a new character could take about 50 developer days and 10 people. New weapon could take 65 days and stuff like that. And while this information is informative, it really doesn't translate that well to the general consumer. As we've said, the consumer can be very fickle with how you present something. You can say the right thing the wrong way in a lot of cases.
Or you can say the right thing the right way, but it's in the context of early access, which somebody who just clicked a buy button on Steam might not understand. So, yeah, it does get sort of tricky where the typical consumer probably shouldn't be buying early access games by and large. Or if they do, they should go in with clear eyes and know what he or she is getting into.
Yeah, and that's, going back to Prison Architect for a quick second, that's why they set the price so high at the start, because they didn't want the general consumer getting into it. They wanted the people who were going to test the hell out of the game and try to break it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the value to them, I guess, is getting all that feedback from people who like to break things and try out all the systems and do all the weird stuff. Yeah, but my suggestion for you is just to put that game down. There's no shortage of other great finished games, and someday that game will be done. It sounds like they're a legit, for real, not going to close up shop in the middle of the night developer, and you'll be able to enjoy it then. That's my advice to you, my unsolicited, unwanted advice.
Yeah, so far we've had a great conversation. We had a really good tangent, I think, regarding perception, especially with like the likes of Payday 2, Killing Floor, and the early access model. But I think it's time to get to our main topic, and that's talking about motivating someone to keep playing a game. This is one of those topics that I'm sure a lot of developers and publishers have spent sleepless nights trying to figure out the magic solution to this. And we've seen so many different philosophies and strategies built into this, from games that go from it from a microtransaction or free-to-play option, like as we said with what they were doing with Payday 2 and the skins. There's, of course, League of Legends and so many more examples. Then there's more implicit forms, you know, a strong gameplay, something that makes you want to keep playing it, story, progression, etc. So, to begin this topic then, I want to just briefly define what I consider to be the two main forms, implicit and explicit, and then I'll let you, Jamie, if you have anything to add, feel free to chime in.
Okay.
So, as I said, For me, there's two main motivators that I see. First is implicit. So this is for the player themselves. Some examples, as I said, would be like a really good story. For instance, take games like Gone Home, The Walking Dead, of course, the Mass Effect trilogy, etc., where the player feels compelled by their own personality, by their own interest in the game to keep playing. It could also be because the game is just a really good game. Stuff like what we see in like Mario Galaxy, the gunplay in something like Call of Duty, etc. Explicit is a little bit more interesting. This is when the developer builds things in to try to keep you playing through like external rewards. So achievements, prestige systems. Call of Duty is a brilliant example of extrinsic rewards designed to keep you playing. Every level you play, you unlock some kind of new little status symbol, some new little weapon, perk, etc. And both systems have very varying use and theories behind them to keep someone playing. There's been a lot of reports on microtransactions and free-to-play social games and how those hooks are trying to get into like that, the quote-unquote, like the gambling persona, trying to get that same kind of hook you get for someone who spends, you know, all day long in a casino pulling the slot machines.
Yep.
So, with that said, do you have anything to add or you want to fill in the blanks that I just said, Jamie?
No, I think it's really interesting, and I agree that the implicit and explicit, you know, labels and those ideas are useful a lot of times for video games. They've been useful in other areas. You know, they used often to explain motivators at work. You know, explicit is money, or, you know, a company car, and implicit motivations would be like you enjoy the work you're doing, or you think it's meaningful, you're developing new skills. And you can sort of map that stuff onto video games as well. But video games are a little bit different in that they're, by and large, for most of us, a voluntary activity. It's something we choose to engage in, although it may not feel like it sometimes. It may feel like we have to, you know, get the next piece of loot or free the next settlement or whatever. But, you know, because they're voluntary activities, there's a number of different sort of psychological theories that are applicable and interesting and can sort of tie into, well, like, why do games always have these sort of systems, like, you know, like you were saying, achievements and quests and progression and ways to show off your gear and leaderboards and all that sort of stuff. And as I mentioned before, I've got a whole chapter in the book that I just released about, you know, how do games get us to sort of grind and chase achievements and keep playing. And it's a chapter all about motivation. And those, you know, there's been a bunch of theories proposed going back a few decades, you know, like Bartle's types, where he looked at like MUDs, massively multiplayer. the sort of precursors to the massively multiplayer games, multi-user dungeons, where he, you know, surveyed people and he said, okay, some people are motivated to kill things, some people are motivated to explore, some people are motivated to socialize. And then, you know, like another researcher, Nick Yee, came and did some additional research on that and did some actual surveying and statistical analysis and found, okay, some people are motivated by the social aspects of the game, and some people are motivated to be immersed in the game, and some people are motivated to achieve things in the game. And he was studying very explicitly like World of Warcraft and EverQuest, like massively multiplayer games. But one of the big theories that I see applied a lot, and there's been a lot of research on, is called self-determination theory, which, like I was talking about earlier, is a theory or a model that tries to explain why we engage in voluntary activities. You know, so outside of like we work so that we don't starve to death, we sleep because we're tired, et cetera, like why do we play games? For example, why do we play video games? And there have been researchers that have applied self-determination theory to games. And there's sort of three psychological needs that are described by self-determination theory: competence, autonomy, and relatedness. And so competence is feeling like you're getting competent, you're having a sense of progression. You're leveling up. You're gaining new skills. You're getting better at the game. And autonomy is sort of having meaningful choices. Like, I have many different options and strategies and things that I can do within this game to make it my own experience. Mm-hmm. And then relatedness is feeling like I'm meaningful to other people. The things that I'm doing are affecting other people. And that obviously comes into play mostly with multiplayer games, you know, where you're part of a team and you're the MVP or the top scorer or the winner. But it also can apply to single player games. You know, there's been some research to show that we perceive non-player characters in a game. Like, if we complete a quest or save the village, then that sort of makes us feel like we're, you know, related to those people and we're satisfying that need. So there's kind of a big setup, but, you know, if you look at each one of those in turn, so, like, you know, competence, it's probably the biggest one. Like, most video games are just stuffed to the brim with signals of competence. You know, when you complete a quest, when you earn an achievement, those are signals to you and to other players of your competence. And so video games have gotten very good at building those signals in and then sort of layering them. You know, you don't just have a quest to bake 100 pies. You have a quest to bake 10 pies and then another quest to bake another 15 pies until, you know, you get to the mastery level in pie making or max out your cooking skill or something like that. So they've gotten very good at building those sort of chains, because if a task or a goal is too far away and it's too big, then it's not very motivating. But if it's within reach, then it's much more motivating. And then they'll overlap different quests and different grinds and different progress meters on top of each other. So, you know, if you've got a game where there's two or three different factions you can be earning reputation with or doing quests for at the same time, then you look at your quest log and there's constantly something that it feels like you're on the cusp of achieving.
Mm-hmm. And really good point, Jamie, about that, especially in recent years. A amazing case in point would be World of Warcraft, and how when Blizzard designed that game, they basically looked at all the MMOs on the market at the time and said, this is what they've done, how can we make it better? How can we get those hooks into the player easier? And when they released it, it was such a breath of fresh air because they removed a lot of, like, the dullness that you have in this game, as we said earlier, with grinding in a lot of games. And, grinding is a really good point. I want to come back to that in a minute. But sticking with what you were just saying in terms of motivators and keeping things going, a great example, as I said a few minutes ago, would be Call of Duty. The Call of Duty progression model is fascinating to look at. I have not bought one Call of Duty game, but I played it during when they had those free weekends. And as you were just saying, they really have it down to a science. Every little thing you do is a progression. Get enough handgun kills, you get something. Get enough assault rifle kills, you get something. Leveling up does something else. And again, it's progression on top of progression, so that no matter what you're doing, no matter how you're playing the game, something is getting close to unlocking for you. You're never going to play the game and nothing happens. You're always getting closer to something else.
Yeah, and it's just one quick hit. You know, each time you get something new to bolt on to your rifle, or you get a new achievement, or you finish a match and you're on the winning team or at the top of the leaderboard, then that's a satisfaction of that basic psychological need to feel competent. So yeah, the most successful games are the ones that layer it and sort of give you something to work towards at any given moment, at several somethings.
Yes. Another game that I like, I think competency is the big one for me. I think if I look at how I play games, that's the one I think is the biggest push for me. I play games until there's nothing more for me to discover, nothing new to learn. I just stop short of like that min-max that we see in a lot of strategy games where people will play them to break them. They know the exact optimization. They know if I do X, Y, and Z, the eye won't be able to handle, I'm going to win every time. I usually stop just before that. Like, for instance, with the Binding of Isaac, that's a good example of, again, that upgrading, that sense of competency. As you grow as a player, the game grows to match. So when you beat the game, you unlock a new item. You unlock a new difficulty variant. You unlock new characters. And it's just, again, progression on top of progression that really does well to hook the player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some games are really sneaky in the way that they get you started down the path towards any one of those goals or any one of those progressions. One of my favorite studies that I talk about has to do with what's called the endowed progress effect, where mm-hmm. if you can sort of frame something or a situation as the person has already undertaken this activity. Like, you know, I give you a quest in a game to go collect 12 widgets. And at the same time that I give you that quest, I give you the first two widgets. Like mm-hmm. you're already, you know, a sixth of the way there. You're already, mm-hmm. you know, begun your progress down that way. And there's also a lot of research to show that once we feel like we've started down the path mm-hmm. towards a goal, it sort of hangs around in our mind and it's more easily brought to mind, and it sort of nags at us and we tend to think about it. So, you know, in situations like that, people are more likely to, you know, pursue that ultimate goal. And as any World of Warcraft, you know, player knows, if you need 12 Gortusk livers, you're not going to stop at 11. You know, you're going to spend whatever amount of time it is needed to find that 12th one and finish that quest up.
Yeah, the classic adage, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that's a really good point, especially when MMOs got smart and let you sort of start a quest before you even get it. Like, if you kill an enemy and you get a quest item that may not be for this quest that you're on, but could be for a quest you'll get later in. Mm-hmm. So you're already making that progress. One of the things that just annoyed me about a lot of earlier MMOs is that you could kill 47 rats or whatever, but unless you're on a quest, it won't really matter. And then you kill those 47, and then you get, oh, by the way, can you kill 20 rats?
Yeah.
And everything that you just did technically didn't matter.
Yeah, I just killed like 80 rats, and you're telling me that none of them had one of the tails that this guy is now asking me for? Yeah.
Yeah. And another good example of streamlining and making these a lot easier, I would say, would be like Guild Wars 2 and a lot of the things they did. Did you play any of Guild Wars 2?
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah.
Yeah, I was saying to some people that I thought that was a great game, but it didn't really have the MMO hook. But they just did such a good job of, again, giving you things to do and giving you reasons to do it. Every little thing you complete on a map builds that completion rate. Mm-hmm. And again, once you start, it's like, well, I'm 75% in. You know, am I just going to really leave this at 75%? Or am I going to go and get it completed? And then there's, of course, a reward for that. And then you do that for every environment in the game.
Yeah, and there's a lot of environments in those games.
Oh, yeah. And that takes me back to what we were talking about a few seconds ago regarding grinding and when that comes in. As anyone will tell you, when a game starts to feel like a grind, it means that the motivation is gone.
Mm-hmm.
When you're just playing it and it feels more like work. As you said at the beginning, Jamie, that what makes games different from other activities is that it is a voluntary action. We're choosing to get into a game as opposed to having to work because you need money. So when a game starts to feel like work, when it feels like nothing is really going your way, it can just be like a brick wall in terms of keeping you motivated to keep going. As I said with Killing Floor 2, I've reached that point where the competency is gone. I know how the game works. I know how things behave. Now it's just me killing guys and watching that little bar fill up mm-hmm. to hopefully get the next progression model.
Yeah, and it's too far away to be motivating.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for bringing that up because I almost forgot. A really good example in terms of moving, as you just said regarding incremental ones, I think that's a huge benefit compared to like far-flung goals. It's a lot easier to say, kill 10 enemies of 10 different types versus saying you have to kill 100 of one type of enemy.
Mm-hmm.
When the goals are small and they're incremental, you see the benefits a lot quicker. And it just makes it a lot more rewarding. The difference between like getting collectibles in Grand Theft Auto, where they only give it to you if you get, you know, all 50 pigeons or all 100 packages, versus a game like Saints Row, where you complete a quest, hey, now you have a superpower.
Yep.
Complete another quest, you get another superpower.
Yeah, yeah, sort of layering it. And then also it's very important to give the player feedback about how much they're progressing. Yes. Was it the Gears of War games that did a really good job of that? They would show you, you know, you might have a goal to get one of the little in-game achievements of like you said, like shooting 1,000 of a particular type of enemy, but they would give you little progress indicators. And then, as you said, it's even more powerful when you get some sort of little reward tacked on to each stage towards the progression of the overall game. You know, you're talking about grinding. One recent experience I had with that, I played Metal Gear Solid 5 earlier this year. And I kind of got to the point where I don't know if it was because there was like a bug or like had something to do with like the servers went down, you couldn't connect, and it caused like all of my in-game resources to go away. I don't know if it was that or it was the fact that like there was this plague that was rampaging through my home base that was like killing all of my people. But a big part of that game is sort of like going out into the field and then fultoning, which is literally like tying this balloon thing to like people, soldiers and items to take them back to your home base. So yeah, you go and you see a guy who's really good at this particular skill you need, and you can knock them out and then Fulton them back to base. And you can do that with vehicles to sell and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, the more resources you have, the more options you have for different things in the game. But like I said, all of a sudden, like all of my stuff was gone and I was in like negative currency, you know, a negative balance on my currency, which meant that like more of my soldiers were abandoning base. And I got to a point in the game where I saw like the sort of the first ending. I guess the game is weird and that has multiple endings. But after that first one, I was just like, I think I'm done, because it's just going to take hours and hours of going back out and fultoning all this stuff to get like back to the place that I was before. And I did it for a couple hours and thought, well, I'm not getting access to any new tech or any new weapons. And so I'm done. And I just quit playing the game.
Yeah. And that's a really good point. When the game begins to feel like you're just spinning your wheels, you're not making any forward momentum, it just really kills. Another big one would be if you're forced to repeat something you've already done. Mm-hmm. Like, as you just said, if there's a bug, or let's say the game didn't properly save and the last two missions didn't count. Repeating content can be just as bad as not having any new content to do, because you've already done it before. So again, all those motivators we just talked about don't really apply. And it can really hurt games in so many ways. Now, the social aspect I find really interesting, because I know you were talking about a few minutes ago regarding the motivators that were found in the MMOs. I think it was like Explorer, Socializer, Warrior, and one other. And the social aspect has never really apply to me, because I've been a single player person for so long. But I know people who they will stick with a game if their friends are playing, and if their friends move to another game, they're going to move to that game as well, because the social aspect is more important to them, or I'm sorry, more motivating to them than the actual playing of the game.
Yeah, that's the relatedness component of self-determination theory, is that, you know, it's motivating, an activity is motivating if you feel meaningful to other people or important to other people when you do it. And you're right. Like, if your entire guild moves to a new game, then you're going to go with them. And if everybody needs you to show up for a raid on a certain night, then you're going to be more motivated to play the game that night and do the prep work that you need to get attuned for the raid or ready for it in whatever way. And if you are, you know, on a team-based game and you're consistently the best player, you know, the top scorer, the clinch player that wins the match, then you're going to be more motivated to keep playing that game because you're important to other people. And I also think that in the same way, you have things like achievements, and I use that term to include like trophies and badges and all that stuff that you get for doing in-game activities, and stuff like gamer score or trophy collections on the PS4 function in the same way, and that there are signifiers to other people about, you know, where you stand relative to them. Like, you know, I am better than you because I got all of these achievements in this game, or you are much more accomplished in this game than I am because you have 1,000 points and I only have 200, you know, of the gamer score points available for that game. So that, you know, all of those things are more or less motivating. And I think it makes a good argument for presenting, especially like achievement and trophy data in terms of like how rare the different achievements are. So, you know, if you complete something or you're trying to work towards something even more relevant, that is a really difficult and really rare achievement that you can see like, oh, according to Steam, like only, you know, 4% of players who play this game get this achievement, then it means a lot more to have it, and it means a lot more to show it off to your friends or to have it show up in their activity stream, you know, when they see what you're doing on Steam or whatever other platform.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is when games try to combine these different motivators together, like if you have an achievement that also unlocks in-game content, such as in The Binding of Isaac, or in social games where, you know, the games will bug you, invite 10 friends and we'll give you, you know, bonus resources.
Right.
And it's all, and those things can be very effective because, again, goes back to that basic element of layering these forms of progression on top of each other so that one thing affects three things. So you're, again, you're always being motivated, you're always being pushed towards something. There's nothing that's ever completely out of your reach.
Yeah. And a lot of those are what I think of as more fitting into the external motivator factor, or some of them anyway. You know, if you spam your friends, then you'll get 10 units of in-game currency. You know, that's sort of an external motivator. Doesn't make the game any more interesting to play. Doesn't necessarily, you know, motivate you to keep playing, but you've got this stuff, so you might as well, you know, use it, which yeah. involves playing the game more, as it turns
exactly.
out.
And as we've been talking about the self-determination theory, Jamie, if there's any like scholarly links you have on it, if you can send those over, I'll include like a few of them in the podcast notes
too. Yeah, I will. There's some great references and some great research and resources on the web.
Yeah. Now, going back to the concept of grinding, I've sort of defined in terms of my point of view, from your research and what you've experienced, what do you consider to be when a game becomes a grind? Like, besides, like, the Metal Gear example.
Well, I think grinding is just doing the same thing over and over again in the hopes that you get a certain outcome. And grinding can be fun, and it can be not fun. You know, I certainly put a lot of time into, like, Diablo 3 on both the PC and the Xbox One, as it turns out. You know, grinding dungeons and rifts over and over and over again just in the hopes that I'll get, like, that certain piece of equipment that I need to complete a set, or enough gems to upgrade my existing equipment, or what have you. And it's fun because, you know, it's rolling the dice each time at the end of the rift, or when you encounter a particularly nasty elite that may drop something good, or you find a treasure chest. You know, it's fun. And sort of as long as you know what you're in for and that's your bag, then go for it. What makes you happy? I think we're grinding becomes demotivating is where you don't get those rewards, or they're delivered on the wrong schedules, or they're too far apart. And, you know, something happens, like in my Metal Gear Solid 5 example, where they dry up and you just do it over and over and over again. You just wander around in the tall grass and Pokemon trying to get random encounters, you know, so that you can level up and up and up and keep going. If there's a goal or an objective, then it's great. But if not, then it becomes a problem, and I personally will move on to something else.
Yeah. Now, I'm glad you brought up Diablo 3, Jamie, because I have a question for you regarding the motivators, because I think I sort of had the answer, but I want to get your take on this, about why the game stops being motivating to me.
All right.
When I play Diablo 3, I find that the leveling up experience, the 1 to 69, is really motivating to keep me playing. I've gotten, I don't even know how many characters I've hit the max cat with. And then once I hit 70, the only form of progression at that point is strictly getting the sets and the legendaries.
Yeah.
I find that I just lose the willpower to keep playing. I've gone so many times up to level 70, but I've barely touched, you know, going the Torment, you know, Torment 5, 6, and all those.
Yeah, I think I have, and I get what you're saying. For you, it's sort of like the game is between levels 1 and 69 or 70. Mm-hmm. But for the hardcore players, the game really starts once you hit the level cap and you start going up into the T1, 2, 3 and beyond levels where you get greater chances of getting epic loots. And that's kind of where I got with those games. You know, I had a bunch of characters and I would be trying to complete sets. And I think a large part of it goes back to, again, this concept of having goals and then sub goals underneath those. So, you know, if I was playing the game, I would be working towards like a particular build. Like I'd want a whirlwind, rend, barbarian that's fire based, for example. So I would have like particular pieces of loot that I was looking for, or would try to get from the transmogrifier to, you know, change attributes to get those pieces of loot. And a lot of times it was the set pieces, the green pieces, where, you know, you'd need them all in order to complete this build. And having that goal helped a lot to keep me motivated to keep playing, because once a session, even if I didn't get one of the set pieces that I needed, I would get, you know, enough resources to try to roll something with the transmogrifier to, you know, improve things, or I'd get pieces for maybe another build that I had in mind. And I think where the game sort of falls down, or where it doesn't work as well as it could be, is that like I had to go out on the web and find out what those builds were. Like, what's the really cool build that I should be working towards? Excuse me. And the game really didn't communicate that to me at all. It didn't give me that information that, like, okay, if I have this set and then I pair it with these items and I have this skill loadout, then I'm going to be death incarnate and I'm going to be able to run tier 10 rifts with no problem. So, yeah, it's all about goals and having those steps along the way to aim for.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think when you hit 70, for me, a lot of the motivators or those incremental goals start to disappear, because then you're really building it just for the long term. You're not thinking about getting one piece of gear in a set. You're thinking about collecting all the pieces in the set. And a lot of the high end, like the meta of the game, is that it's really all or nothing. You either get all the pieces to get the ultimate set bonus, or the set just doesn't really work for you.
Sometimes, although even incomplete sets can be pretty rad and have lots of different powers. And again, the way that Diablo structures it is that, okay, if you have two of the six items in the set, you'll get this bonuses. Yeah. And then if you have five of the six, you'll get these additional bonuses. And then you get that sixth piece and you get like the whole thing. So at least you're getting rewarded.
Yeah, you get like the game breaking when it was given to you any other way kind of power.
Yeah.
And I would love for them to add more competency-based goals once you get past Tournament 1. Like, I would like to see like more challenges. I know with the recent season, they added in like the season's journey. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to add more of those in-between or those short-term goals to it, which I thought was a really good idea. And I'm really hoping to see more of that stuff with the next season, which sounds like they're really taking a big step forward in terms of upgrading Diablo 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I say it about Blizzard. They're certainly willing to keep pouring money and change things up.
Mm-hmm. And they will just keep working. They really got that core down. I mean, even with like StarCraft 2 is another good example. They have gotten the motivators really embedded in that game. There's the whole single player campaign, then you have achievements, then you got the whole multiplayer progression. And all these things are little ways. I think you were talking about a few minutes ago regarding like relating to other players. There's the whole aspect of your ranking in multiplayer that can be huge. Yeah. For people, we've seen like companies base their entire game on like League of Legends. It's not just about how you do in a match, it's about your career profile and allowing you to play, you know, tournament level play. And of course, there's always that allure of, if I get good enough at a game, I can maybe go pro. And esports has definitely risen out of that need or that desire to become the best and be acknowledged for it.
Yeah, or even not even the best, but just good enough to have an entertaining stream on Twitch or YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I know about that. I've been trying to do that on my own time as well with the YouTube channel and the daily Twitch streams.
Yep.
But yeah, it's all about trying to get that motivation to keep playing. And for the games that do work, I mean, there are games I'm sure people have spent, you know, 500, 600 hours on. I know a few people who've played Team Fortress 2 probably over 1,000 hours in that game. And when it works, it's great. But when it doesn't work, once you lose that desire to play a game, it's very hard to get it back. Now, I guess here's a quick aside regarding that, Jamie. Have you had any of that experience, like a game that just you've lost all will to keep playing and then it did something to pull you back? Or was it once it's lost, it's gone for good?
That's a good question. Kind of the only game that I will go back to again and again is actually Team Fortress 2. And whenever they do something big, like, you know, the co-op mode that they rolled out, or the weapons, what was it, the contracts system that they implemented, or every every Halloween they'll do like a new Halloween map and event. Like, I'll go back in and check that stuff out. It doesn't hurt that it's a free to play game. Although I got it with the orange box way back in the day. So,
yeah, me too. Seems like we're so old. I know. We played it before the items and all the crazy stuff that
happened. I know, right? But that's about it. It's just because I try to play so many games. I'm on to the next shiny thing once a game bores me. And I'll go back into that franchise. Like, I'm playing Fallout 4 because I enjoyed the previous game so much. But that's typically what it takes to bring me back in. It's like a new entry into the franchise.
Yeah. Now, as a quick tangent, just more of a psychological question for you, Jamie, regarding going in or playing a game. I know I haven't heard any like official studies, but from a general consensus, I can't even talk anymore. My mouth's completely dry. But a general opinion is that for most gamers, when they get a new game, they will like give it like maybe 10 to 20 minutes of their time to see whether or not they like it, they get into it. If they do, they keep playing. If they don't, they, you know, throw it, you know, put it on the pile and go to the next one. Has there been like any like official or scholarly studies on like that 15, 20 minutes of whether or not I'm going to accept this game or not?
I don't know of anything that's been published on that, though. You know that companies have those data.
Yeah.
Because they can track on a lot of platforms, they're able to track, you know, how long do people play and whether or not they ever came back and what parts of the game they played. So you gotta think the information is out there. I think that sort of behavior is gotta be mediated by how much you invested in the game. So if I buy a $60 game, I'm probably going to put more than 10 minutes into it. And I would expect other people to do that as well. But if I download a free to play game, I may give it 10 seconds before I get rid of it and move on to something else, which is probably a whole other conversation and a whole other sort of can of worms for the industry.
Definitely.
But I think that there probably is a relationship between how much you pay and how much you're willing to endure before deciding that you do or don't like something.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Jamie, regarding the price perception. And this also goes back to the older industry, you know, the 90s and the early 2000s, when there were no game sales. You may have bought one game a month, and that's it. You know, compared to today, where we can spend $10 on a Humble Bundle and get 10 games or more. And again, like, price can be such a huge factor there. If I'm spending if I buy a game like Fallout, you know, brand new $60, I want, you know, put as much time into that to get my money's worth. If I buy a game on sale for like $4 or $5, it's like, yeah, if I stop playing after an hour, big whoop, I just, you know, I'm out $5 versus 60 plus.
Yeah, and in fact, I just had an experience like this the other night. It's before Fallout 4 was out, and I was between games, so I went to my Steam backlog and I installed Wolfenstein. Not the New Order, it's the Old Blood, right? It's the standalone game that was sort of the prequel to the first one. And I had gotten it for a few bucks on some Steam game, Steam sale at some point. And I got in, I started playing through, and slight spoiler, I guess, for the first few minutes of the game, but they do the thing where they take away all your weapons and put you in a jail cell, and you have to sneak out and you have to get out. And the stealth system in that game is not good. And I kept getting one-shotted and in these you know, these situations I couldn't get out of because somebody spotted me, uninstalled the game after maybe like an hour of messing with it. Just like, nope, I've got too many other options, and I didn't pay a whole lot for this game, so no thanks.
Yeah, when the game is cheap, you're definitely more inclined to spot those problems and have them affect you more. I mean, I've had a lot of games like that where I will play a game for like literally like 2-3 minutes, and I just like throw my hands up and go, nope, done, I'm not dealing with this, let's go on to the next
game. Yeah, at this point in my life, I've got more games than I do time, so.
Yeah, which is a huge difference from back in the day, of course. But yeah, that's a discussion for another time, because that will be another hour or 2 hours on top of this one.
Easy.
So, I think with that, I'm starting to run out of questions myself. Are there any other topics relating to game motivating, whether implicit or explicit, that you would like to bring up now, Jamie?
I think we hit on a lot of good points. There's more to it, but like you said, it'll be another hour's worth of conversation, so maybe you'll have to have me come back on again at some point.
Yep, definitely. Love to have you back on. So, I guess one last question relating to this topic. Were there any other interesting insights or studies that regarding motivating someone to play that are in your book?
In terms of motivating
like someone to keep playing or to come back to a game or stuff like that?
One of the items or one of the motivators that we didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about was that autonomy, like feeling that you have choices when you play a game, and just simply the fact of like having a bunch of side quests or a bunch of goals or achievements to try to pursue motivates you to play the game, because you feel like you're in control and you're expressing some, you know, power over how things turn out. And there's a concept called psychological reactance, where it means that we hate to lose options once we have them. And there was a great study done by Dan Ariely and some of his colleagues from Duke University, where they had subjects play sort of a rudimentary video game on a screen where they had like three doors, like virtual doors on the screen, and they had a limited number of clicks. Like say they had, I don't know what it was, but say like 100 clicks. And clicking on a door to open it cost one click. And then once they were inside a room, they could keep clicking inside the room to earn like cash. So, you know, one of the doors might pay between like 6 and 18 cents per click. And so the goal was kind of to find out which of the three doors paid the most money. But it was interesting. They added the twist that if you neglected one of the other three doors long enough, it would sort of start to shrink and then it would disappear and you wouldn't be able to click on it anymore. But that was irrelevant once you found which of the doors paid the most money, right? If your goal was just to get the most money, you shouldn't care that the other ones disappeared. But what they found is that people would spend their limited clicks to like back out of a room, go click on one of the other doors to reset it so that it wouldn't disappear, get less money than they'd gotten before, and then they'd go back to the other door. And they kept doing this over and over again. It was irrational because they were costing themselves money with each one of those clicks, but they just hated the idea of losing that option. And I think we see this in video games a lot of times, where we have, you know, side quests that may be contingent upon supporting a particular faction or taking a certain path through the game. And it's really stressful to see like things disappear from your quest log without completing them, you know, because of a choice you made. And I think it's interesting how game developers can sort of apply that pressure to gamers. And I think it's something that could be done a lot more. And in the book, I sort of drew the parallel to the BioWare game romances, you know, like that's sort of one of their signature things is that there will be NPCs and you can sort of pursue them romantically. But most of the time, if not all the time, you know, once you go through all the way with that chain of events for one character, it closes the other ones off. And so what I tended to do was sort of delay like taking that final step with any one character so that I could sort of keep the other romantic interests, you know, strung along. Not because I was just trying to play the field or anything like that, but just I didn't like the idea of that option going away. And maybe that maybe that draws more parallels to real life than I'm comfortable admitting. But it is interesting. It's an interesting example of how actual real psychological research can be applied to video game design.
Interesting. All right. Here's my last question then for you, Jamie, and then we will start to wrap things up. As we talked about with the self-determination theory and the three classes of motivators, as a somewhat of a tangent or aside, I was just wondering, the whole clicker phenomena that we've seen grown, you know, starting as a joke from cow clicker to stuff like cookie clicker and so many other games with the word clicker in the title, how would they fit in terms of motivating someone to keep going?
Yeah, those are really weird. In a lot of ways, yeah. I don't get them. I think part of it has to do with that psychological reactance phenomenon that I just described, where you know, you click your cow because you don't you don't want it to go away, or you just like seeing numbers go up. And
yeah,
I don't know. Other than that, it's just sort of seeing numbers go up. It's almost like they're hijacking a part of our brain that in most situations is adaptive and useful. And here it's totally pointless.
Yeah, it's that allure of, you know, that progression, you know, that I'm watching this get bigger and bigger and bigger. So I'll unlock something else that can go up and get bigger and bigger.
But without meaning. Yeah.
Exactly.
Or consequence. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's gotten me a few times. I've managed to shrug it off, but it always just comes back and gets me after like a few weeks or months of not playing.
Yeah, I don't get those games. Was it Cow Clicker and what, there was one about cookies?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yep. So I think with that, we had a great conversation tonight, and we're going to wrap things up. I think to sort of sum up our discussion in terms of motivating someone to play, the best ways, I think we both agree on, are definitely constant small goals. As we said, progression layer on top of progression works wonders to keep someone playing. When you have something to shoot for, it just is such a great motivator. And then when you have multiple things that all build on top of that, you're never without something to do. I think that's sort of the key point. As long as there's something out there for you to achieve, something within your grasp, it's going to keep players coming. I forget the exact phrase. What was it? Delayed gratification. When you start with something, you have to finish it.
Oh, the endowed progress effect.
Endowed progress effect. I think that's another big one as well. And again, it just gets back to this key point that when you have these different goals to achieve, as long as you have something on the back burner, something to reach for, you'll keep a player invested. The second they run out of things to do, when they hit that wall and becomes a grind, you've pretty much lost them as a future customer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So with that, we're going to end things here. Again, Jamie, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And yeah, we definitely have to have you back on some more because these are always great conversations.
Yeah, they're always a lot of fun. I always like talking shop. So anytime.
Yeah, me too. Nice. And for those of you listening, be sure to check out Jamie's book. That's Getting Gamers, The Psychology of Video Games and Their Impact on the People Who Play Them. You can find links to that on his website, psychologyofgames.com. There'll be links to that in the podcast notes below. Be sure to check that out. And with that said, we're going to end things here. So for those of you listening, thanks a lot for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support GameWisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to submit a guest piece or be a future podcast guest, you can find the guidelines and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under GameWisdom, and you can click that little Patreon banner on the front page. We are currently looking to hit that first goal, and any donations, no matter how big or small, would be greatly appreciated. And lastly, if you'd like to watch my streams and my videos on games, a wide variety of games actually, you can find me on YouTube as well as Twitch. There are links to that on the front page. Twitch, I usually stream nightly around 10 Eastern under the channel GW Bicer. So, again, Jamie, it was a pleasure hanging out with you, and hopefully we can have you back on. And yet, definitely a lot of fun just talking about these topics, and there is so much more we could get into. I mean, if we didn't have family and other things, we could probably talk for the next few hours.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, again, thanks a lot for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.